Welcome to this episode of The DeMartini Show. Today, Dr. DeMartini discusses the mind-body connection and how we have the power to influence our health and vitality when we learn how to govern our minds. Dr. John DeMartini is a human behavior specialist and began his professional career as a chiropractor. He spent over 48 years researching everything that he could find in order to understand the essence of healing, as well as to understand what drives human behavior and performance and the most efficient and effective ways to empower and inspire lives. If you're a healer or someone interested in understanding the essence of healing, then you're in for a treat. Get ready for a powerful presentation and make sure that you have a pen and paper ready because you're going to want to take loads of notes. Enjoy.
So with the current global pandemic, health is more meaningful than ever. So let's start with immunity. What are the factors that play a role in increasing or decreasing immunity?
Okay. An individual, their immune system, first I'd like to develop something about that.
Absolutely.
The immune system for many, many decades was considered a system that was the first defense, in a sense. The skin, the lungs, the bowel, kidney were defenses against microorganisms that were considered other than self. That model led to the germ theory, where we took antibiotics to get rid of all bacteria and all rickettsia and viruses and parasites and things of this nature. That has, for many years, been debated, and it didn't always work because sometimes the immunity of the individual was strong, and they could be in a setting where six people were getting sick and one wasn't. And so what was the difference in that one? Or five were getting sick and two weren't. They now know, as of the last few decades, gradually, even though I was talking about this and laughed at back 40 years ago, they now know that the immune system is an additional sensory system, a sensory system. They've added to one of the senses now that's actually sensing the receptor sites of microorganisms and giving the brain feedback to let the brain know what is the ratio of various bacteria in the microbiome. And the microbiome is every tissue, every organ has its own microbiome. So now they know that the immune system is regulating the ratios of bacteria, viruses, rickettsia, et cetera, and keeping them in check. Because we have viruses and bacteria and microorganisms that build and destroy our body that are necessary. And if one gets out of whack, we create symptomatology to get us back. And now we know that it's there trying to regulate it. So the antibiotic era is now coming to a close. It'll be there for emergencies. But the idea, the microbiome era is here. So now instead of getting rid of, with an antibiotic, get rid of all the bacteria or something, or viruses, we're now bringing in predators, like an ecosystem that we're doing out there in the wild, bringing in a predator and changing the ecosystem. So now they're bringing in microorganisms and actually put them into the body that consume other organisms that are in excess, and putting a wildlife management system together. So the immune system is a regulator of the microbiome and lets the brain know. Now, the thing that makes the immune system work the most effectively is the same things that I've been saying all along on how to live your life most effectively. When you're living by your highest values, first defining them clearly and not guessing, not speculating, not hoping there's something, but actually looking at what your life really demonstrates and living by highest values, you're more objective. When you're more objective, you're more balanced in orientation. And you're more likely to not have the fear of loss of something that you're normally attached to, or the fear of gain of something that you're more avoiding, the prey and predator model. And you're more resilient. And as a result of that, your immune system is able to embrace the two sides of the bacterial equation and keep them in check. But when we go down into lower subcortical brain areas, we go into the amygdala area, and we skew and distort our perceptions and get really subjectively biased, and accentuate as a survival mode a heightened perception of prey or a heightened perception of predator, then our immune system's perception is altered. And we tend to get more out of balance with what that microbiome is. And then our symptomatology corresponds to it. So anything we can do to live by priority helps the immune system. Anything we can do that doesn't cause perturbation and distortion helps the immune system. Drinking water instead of all the other things that we could be drinking, believe it or not, that are loaded with sugar. Sugar is probably the most unwise thing to be eating in your life. It's the most common thing that people eat. It's the most addictive substance on the planet, but it causes volatility and it has an increasing probability of kind of a manic depressive state to the immune system and disturbs it. So water, breathing deeply, doing something that's deeply meaningful and inspiring, making sure that you have something that you feel fulfilled in, if you will, because that way you don't have to fill full your body to do it and overconsume. Anything that keeps rhythm and consistency and moderation and function is going to help the immune system. The immune system's already got enough to deal with to maintain a balance. Don't perturb it by the extremes of behavior or extremes of perception, emotion, et cetera, which perturb it. Anytime we perceive more challenge than support, our sympathetic nervous system comes online. And that suppresses some of the immune responses and accentuates others. And we can get to cause mediators and cytokines and other compounds to be heightened. We can get what they call a cytokine storm because of inflammation. So if we're inflamed and highly emotional about things, we actually aggravate things. So anytime we get in highly infatuated, we fear its loss. Anytime we get highly resentful and fear its gain, we automatically accentuate the polarities of the immune system. Instead of calming it down, we tend to get to an extreme and we're vulnerable. And then our symptoms and our microorganisms, our microbiome, lets us know that. So anything we can do to make our immune system more stable is going to be to our advantage. Now, I'll use the analogy of this, the coronavirus. I'm assuming maybe you're going to ask that anyway. I don't know, but
we have, one on.
Well, let me just develop it. And if I've covered it, I've covered it. The lungs, which is where most of the effect of the coronavirus is. Now, we know it goes into the brain, it goes in the intestines, it goes to different things and different people. There's a lot of mutations that are going on right now. And in bats and other species, it's known to do that. But in us, it's primarily a respiratory condition. We have the first defense of that. We have autoimmune cells, what they call primary macrophages. And we also have the cilia of the lining of it. We also have inside the lining of the lungs, we literally have mucosal secretions and things, serous secretions that have antibodies and advanced part of the immune system to fight off infections. If we are imbalanced, those first defense mechanisms of the lung are not great. And if we're heightened in our emotions and we find out, oh my God, I got coronavirus, and we're gonna freak out, oh my God, we're actually going to accentuate the problem, because we're going to create inflammatory mediators, which is part of the reason why we have the problem. Some people are asymptomatic, then get stressed. They don't even know they have coronavirus. And then they get stressed. They find out, oh my God, I got coronavirus because I've now got a test and it's now proven that. Now they're heightened. Their mediators go on into extreme things. And now they full blow into corona things and they end up with lung problems and further development. So calm, centered. This is where things like true meditation could be very valuable. Doing the DeMartini method could be very valuable. Making sure that you're not going down in your amygdala and going to an extreme behavior and addictive behaviors with sugars and other addictive behaviors. All of those systems right there will help our immune system. And some of it's common sense, but some of it's not commonly done.
And Dr. DeMartini, what happens when somebody gets a specific illness, like a liver disorder versus a brain tumor, or blood issues versus being infected by this coronavirus? How is an emotion resulting to one or other illness?
Well, it depends on the stress, perception of distress. When you're doing something you really love to do and you're challenging yourself to go and accomplish something that's really deep and meaningful to you, you actually help the overall immune system. That has been proven. It's a hermetic, not a hermetic, but a hormetic process, which means a little bit of challenge and a little bit of stress is actually to our advantage. And that's what eustress is about. Selecting the challenges. I've said before that if you don't fill your day with high priority actions that inspire you, it fills up with low priority distractions that don't. If you fill your day with challenges that inspire you, you don't keep attracting challenges that don't. If you fill your day with stresses and distresses, if you will, or eustress, things that really that you want to tackle that are challenging but inspiring to do, you help the immune system. And as long as you're filling your day with high priorities, it doesn't fill up with low priorities, which are distressful, because that's the things you don't want. Distress is seeking a fantasy and then attracting its opposite and then having to deal with it when you don't want to deal with it. That's what distress is. But when you're pursuing challenges and inspire, it's not distress, it's eustress. And that actually is a hermetic thing that actually helps the immune system towards wellness. It actually calms down, neutralizes, again, because we're objective. So if you have a liver disease is a digestive derivative. It comes out of a pouch, you might say, coming out of the duodenum, just like the pancreas does. And so the sympathetic nervous system shuts down the digestive system when you're perceiving fight or flight, when you're perceiving things that challenge your values. And when you're perceiving things that support your values, all your blood and everything goes into the digestive tract to help you rest and digest. So if you're perceiving a loss of that which you infatuate with, or a gain of that which you're trying to resent, your sympathetic comes on, you shut down the system, you slow the bowels, you slow the secretion of the bowels, you suppress the immune system of the bowels, and the liver, and the pancreas, and the gut, stomach, and the esophagus, all the way through from mouth to anus, that whole thing shuts off, and all the blood glucose and all that goes out to the periphery, into the striated muscles of the periphery of the body for fight or flight, ready to run or to fight. So the digestive system is, you're not gonna be eating in the middle of a fight. So that shuts down, and when it shuts down and it dries up and it gets, in a sense, not having its immune function, then you're vulnerable. And liver disease is a chronic, consistent, distressful, sympathetic response that's shutting down the immune system and backing up the portal vein, which is a digestive draining system from the gut into the back into the portal system, into the liver. And it's congesting. And instead of making a fluidic bile, it's now hardening of the bile, thickening of the bile, and it gets congested and it's inflamed and we get liver problems. That's why I said a chronic anger and gall has been known for centuries to have an impact on the liver. So the liver represents, in a sense, a consistent, it could be sometimes acute if it's really, really extreme, but a consistent chronic anger and digestive system that's shut down. Brain tumors are a little different. First of all, brain tumors are a misnomer. Most people think of the brain, they think of the nervous system, but there's very few neurological tumors. Most tumors is actually what they call glial sites or meningocytes. So we have the meninges, the three layers of the brain itself that surround the brain tissue, the pia mater, arachnoid matter, arachnoid space, and the dura mater. And then you also have the glial cells. And most tumors of the brain are glial, glioblastoma, glioma, right? There's many different types of gliomas, but these are mainly glioma cells. These are the constructive cells that are involved in the lymphatic system, the immune system, the thing that regulates the nutrition of it. The glial cells are way more important than the nerve cells. The nerve cells are kind of, they're like passive little actors in the game of the brain, but most of the tumors are that way. And what's interesting is they found a marker, one of the main markers, the telomerase enzyme, and TERT is a marker that most brain tumors are registering. And what's happening is this telomerase enzyme is allowing the telomeres to continue to grow. So you got little immortal cells and these cells don't stop. So they target that with chemotherapy and radiation and things. But what they're doing is that these cells just keep going and they just keep going. So there's a feedback there to try to get us back to our highest values, to see things on the way, because that's what happens when we're doing something to our values, our telomeres extend again. It's trying to get us there, but what's going on is it's gone to extreme. And when you find out in cancer patients, you have extreme polarities like always and nevers stacked up, which is why in the breakthrough experience, I have people do column 5 and 12 so consistently, When I was 24 years old, I was the president of the Cancer Prevention Control Association in Houston, Texas. I had an opportunity, a young guy, to do that. And I saw these patients, lots of patients that had cancer, that had these black and white, absolute, all or none thinking and language. I first noticed it then. I've been noticing it ever since. It hasn't changed. And so I put that into the Demartini method for that purpose, to stop the labels of extreme labels, which tend to regress not only our immune system, our enzymatic system, our receptor site system. Our entire function goes and regresses to primitive cell functions, down to extremophilic cells when we do that. And the glial cells in the brain are no different. And they're the basic lymphatic system of the brain. And when we don't drain the brain of the toxic proteins, we get neurodegenerative disease in addition to the tumor. So we must have, again, no matter what I do, I'm going to go back to the same thing. We must go back to live by our highest values, to be more objective, to keep more balanced, to keep the astrocytes, to open up the lymphatic system of the brain, to drain it, to get the proteins out, which is the toxic things that start making cells lose oxygen and increase the probability of glial site tumor formation. And it also tends to, as a feedback mechanism, try to get the telomeres to go up to get us back onto higher priority, longer focused systems. Immediate gratification costs you. Long-term vision pays. Now, you said, I think you had liver cancer. What was the other one that you mentioned? Is there another one? Camille?
Blood issues, Dr. DeMartini, blood.
Okay, blood issues. Well, your red blood cell is involved in carrying oxygen and CO2, basically. The hemoglobin is picked up on that. And the red blood cell is primarily for daytime. That's the reason why the red blood cell is sickle-shaped, not sickle, but concave, biconcave shape, is because it has no nucleus, and it has to slide in between all the different capillaries in order to get into to carry the oxygen to the tissue cells and also take out the CO2 to go into the pulmonary circulation to get oxygen and go into the normal circulation to bring oxygen and then take the CO2 back out to lungs to expire external respiration. Internal respirations at the cell level for balancing out the O2 and CO2, but the external is bringing in oxygen and letting out CO2, external respiration. The red blood cell is mainly for the day, because most of the time we're active during the day. That's when the sympathetic nervous system is on. That's when we need the lungs open for breathing. That's when the muscles are active. And so there's a sympathetic autonomic nervous system is active during the day, and they're associated with red blood cells. The sympathetic neurons stimulate red blood cell formation. And it actually, the cycle in the spleen of destruction and also the production of it, the myeloid tissues and the bone, are all regulated by the sympathetic impact. So during the day, when we're in sympathetic activity, we're ready for taking on the challenges of the day, hopefully doing what's highest on our priority, our red blood cells are fine. And that's what I normally do. And they're anuclear because radiation damages the DNA during the day. So we have anuclear cells predominantly. And the white blood cells are mainly down. But at night, when the sun sets, the white blood cells now come up. They're very large nucleated cells. Monocytes and macrophages have large nuclei. They're very sensitive to radiation damage. So they come out at night, and they're deal with the parasympathetic nervous system and the estrogen. Testosterone stimulates the red blood cells and estrogen stimulates the white blood cells. So there's a bit of a dimorphism, a sexual dimorphism in some of the expression of these cells. So what happens is when you're under distress and you're in the middle of the night sleeping and your red blood cells are now coming out and your white blood cells are suppressed, and then during the day, the red blood cells are, you know, already been going through their time cycle and they only have 120 days to function anyway, then what happens, you're throwing these systems out. That's why the suprachiasmic nucleus and the up in the thalamus, hypothalamus, is actually making sure that you have day-night rhythms. That works for the pineal gland, it works for the optic systems, the subcortical optic systems, to make sure that all your cells are having and all your mitochondria in the cells are going through normal cycles to keep the body working with day and night cycles. When you throw your day and night cycles off, you throw your immune system off. So it's important to find some sort of a consistent rhythm, if you can, with your sleeping pattern, your eating pattern. If you might want to study chronobiology and study some of the cycles during the day and know how those cycles work, to know what to be doing at what time of the day, theoretically. Now, me, when I'm traveling all the time, I have crazy time zones. I'm sure it's taken its toll. But at the same time, having a rhythm and making it consistent and doing things in moderation and doing something that's meaningful and doing something that's inspiring and living by your highest value and drinking water, which is a universal solvent, and making sure that you're keeping your testosterone and estrogen balanced, because if you're infatuated with a male or a female or resentful to a male and female, you tend to throw those off. The more you're challenged and resentful to things, the testosterone goes up. Whenever you're supported, your estrogen goes up. And those throw those systems out of whack. So that's why stabilizing your emotions help the immune system. And the cells that are blood cells or whatever are letting you know it. They're giving you feedback to let you know that you're out of whack with your perceptions, your decisions, and your actions in life.
Thanks for that, Dr. DeMartini. The next question we got from one of our attendees is, does true meditation translate to parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system being in balance? Example, neither being dominant.
It depends on the meditation. There are many, many forms and expressions of meditation. And the breathing is the main factor. How you breathe has an impact on your autonomics. If you do long exhalations and short inhalations, you're going to activate the parasympathetic nervous system. If you take somebody who's really manic and really elated and really excited, they're going to breathe long inhalations and blow out quickly. If you get somebody who's depressed, they're going to take in a gasp of air and they're going to let it out slowly. So long exhalation, short inhalation is parasympathetic. Long inhalation, short exhalation is sympathetic. So if the breathing is one-to-one, you balance it. So your breath, as the breath wanders, so is the mind. As the mind wanders, so is the breath. That's why if you're highly emotional, the breathing is erratic. But if you can control the breath, that's one area of the body. The diaphragm is the one area of the body that you have governance between voluntary and involuntary. It can involuntarily run or you can voluntarily overrule it. That's why the yogis have been using it for centuries, and all people that understand respiration know how to use the breath wisely. So when you breathe in a one-to-one ratio or possibly a rhythm, you breathe in for 7 seconds or 5 seconds, you hold for 5 or 7 seconds or 10 seconds, depending how long and adept you are. You then breathe out for 5, 7, or 10 seconds, and then you hold for 5, 7, or 10 seconds. I say 5, 7, or 10 because the average person can't do cycles of 10 seconds without training. They can do 5 to 7, 6 to 7 maybe, but they can't do 10. Very few people can do that. Hold 10 seconds, inhale 10 seconds, exhale 10, hold 10 seconds, exhale 10 seconds. But if you bring those into balance, your physiology goes into balance, and your sympathetic and sympathetic tend to, and parasympathetic tend to go into balance. And so it depends on what you're doing with your meditation. It depends on the breathing that you're doing. It depends on what the content of your mind is that you're focusing on. If you're doing a contemplative meditation, you're thinking about something and that's disturbing you, it can throw that off. But if you're going in transcendental meditation where you're transcending it and just observing it, that has a place. That could be where all of a sudden the autonomics go back into balance. So it depends on the meditation, but it is a very useful tool if wisely done, not to avoid a pain and go off onto a fantasy. That's an escape meditation. I don't recommend those, but to actually use it to transcend or to integrate. I prefer to take the information that you're going to that's disturbing your mind, all the noise in the brain, and take it and sort through it with the DeMartini method and clear it where you see the order and see the synchronicities of opposites. If you do, you have the highest probability of bringing autonomic equilibrium. And that's what brings the wellness factor. We used to think because of the animal nature, the amygdala has been ruling most of healthcare, and people want to get rid of symptoms, and they think that health is a removal of symptoms, even though in medicine, most of the treatment is not a cure, it's a palliative treatment to get rid of symptoms. I mean, if the symptoms are going, oh, you think you're cured, which is stupidity, really, because your body is trying to give you those symptoms to let you know you're off balance. So you're cutting out, getting rid of the symptoms, or basically stopping the feedback mechanism to teach you something, and that whole model, in my opinion, needs to be adjusted. But if you know how to regulate and take the symptoms and discover what, I just finished the Prophecy 2 program. We went over a lot of symptoms, a lot of diseases and what they might mean. And so in the process of doing that and discover that, and then integrate that and put the pairs of opposites together in the brain by doing column 6 and 13 of the DeMartini method that I teach in the Breakthrough Experience. If you go in there and do that, your brain automatically goes into a meditative state, which is centered, and you balance out your autonomics. If you perceive something challenging you and not supporting you, and you skew your perception on that, your sympathetic nervous system comes online. If you perceive yourself supporting you and not challenging you, your parasympathy goes out of line. Both can lead to illness. If you get over parasympathy, you get it. Over alkaline, you get it. Right now, this whole thing about getting rid of acid and go on to alkaline, that's valuable if you're acid. Time to get alkaline. But if you're alkaline, you don't want to go further alkaline. Your body, you need to go and check and not just presume just because somebody's marketed you something. You need to make sure you do it. And that's where breathing and balanced breathing comes in. You can literally balance your breath. Your kidneys and your lungs are your two primary buffers for pH. And those are the two main ones. And so the lungs have to be between around 7 degrees or 7.4 degrees, the blood, the plasma. So what happens if it goes too far one way or too far the other way, you get alkalosis or acidosis. And so you want to make sure that you keep those in balance. Now, most of those buffers are working, but in many cases, those buffers get skewed by high stress responses or sedation. I had people the other day that I was working with, they've been in now sitting indoors for 2.5 to 3 months, and they're losing their drive because they feel futile, and they're going too parasympathetic, and they're sleeping too much, and they're going too far parasympathetic, and they need some activity, and they need to fill their minds with priorities and get creative and quit being a victim of the world around them. Or otherwise, they'll get symptoms on the other side. Instead of the distressed response, you now got the too much kicking back and do nothing response. Both of those lead to illness. Sometimes sedentary work and continued eating creates obesity, and there's tons of conditions with that. And overdoing it and over-relaxing makes atrophy of bone, muscle, all kind of tissues start to break down because they're not used. You don't use them, you lose them. Just like the guy going into space and there's no gravity, the bones start deteriorating, etc. So if you're not doing enough activity and not a challenge enough, the parasympathetic will automatically cause some problems and you'll pay.
Listen up. Imagine knowing with absolute certainty that your life is working for you, that you're on track and that you're making progress towards the goals and dreams that you desire every day. If you've been an avid listener to this podcast, you'll have heard Dr. DeMartini mention his signature program, The Breakthrough Experience. It's a 2-day weekend seminar where he shows you how to take everything that you've been learning on this podcast and put it into practice so that you can gain the shifts that you most desire for your life. If you would love to transform your life, and if you've been a little bit uncertain where to start or how to get there, then join Dr. John DeMartini at The Breakthrough Experience so he can show you how. What you'll learn in these 2 days is truly life transforming. It's time to put the power in your hands to create your magnificent life. To find out more, go to demartini.fm/seminar. You can also access the link in the show notes below. We look forward to seeing you there. And now let's continue with this episode.
Price there. You need a balancing act.
And Dr. DeMartini, what role does genetics play in disease?
Well, that's interesting. I just wrote a thing last night, well, yesterday afternoon, actually, on genetics. And I've been fascinated by genetics and epigenetics, as you probably guessed. I just made the statement, and I'm going to boldly state this, that I'm now convinced that because we have this fantasy that life is good and death is bad, which there's no indication of that whatsoever, except in human psychology, human physiology, human sociology, and human theology. And even in theology, it's kind of quite skewed. That we've made an idea that all genetic defects, all genetic mutations are deleterious. But the real truth is that not all gene mutations are necessarily bad. We must have some adapting, primarily radiation, ionizing radiation, primarily UV light, primarily teratogenic toxic chemicals, sometimes toxic chemicals that we create in our own body. And then there's epigenetic alterations that are doing it. More and more of the genetic defects are now being found to have also an epigenetic impact. Because we now know that we can cause duplications, deletions, and some aneuploidic behaviors in cancers from which are re-scrambling of DNA and heightened extensions of DNA and complete transpositions of DNA by epigenetics. Well, if that can be the case, And not only in the transcription of the DNA for making proteins that affect all the receptors and transmitters and all kind of thing, but just that ability means that the so-called genetic defects that we once thought that were random may not be random after all. And they may be deleterious for a purpose. Because as I went through a bunch of conditions just yesterday afternoon, I realized that almost each DNA mutation has advantages and disadvantages. And it's there, it's in the literature. And it's quite a interesting thing. So sometimes having a species die is actually to the benefit of the group. And sometimes having a deletion of a gene or a point mutation is actually going to confer advantages for other conditions. So what we once just had this blanket idea that DNA mutations are bad, I'm now coming from the perspective that DNA mutations are not one random, they have a purpose, and that may not be considered good or bad, they're neither, because the only reason you label them good and bad is because you narrow your minded about with an assumption that life is good and death is bad. So if it didn't make it live, that must be bad, and so a DNA mutation is bad, when in fact that's not the case. They did a thing at Chernobyl with plants and animals around the Chernobyl where they had the radiation damage. And they found out that many of the species have adapted within 2 and 3 generations, amazing adaptations, and are now more flourishing around the radiation. And they've got complete adaptation systems. When I was 23, 24, I wrote a book, The Illusional Basis for Man's Health and Disease, How Perceptual Illusions Affected Illness. And in the process of doing that, I found a section I wrote on repair enzymes. Now that's grown a lot in the last 40 years. The repair systems are good. But now I'm starting to think that the repair systems are not repairing necessarily to be the original DNA. Some of the repair systems are epigenetically molded to adapt to the new environment to be more useful than just repairing it to the old way. I used to think that it just repaired the DNA so it was stable. Now I'm realizing that the DNA itself is actually being modified by epigenetics based on environment in order to adapt like bacteria do. Bacteria can adapt really quickly, and all of a sudden you can have a toxic in a petri dish of the bacteria, and a matter of hours later there's some that are thriving again because they epigenetically are adapting to it and causing changes. And we have the capacity with our DNA to morph the form and expression of it, the regulatory and so-called junk DNA, particularly multicellular organisms, to be able to adapt. So I'm now convinced, and I wrote that up just yesterday, that the mutations, instead of just like bugs used to be all bad, we got to get rid of them with an antibiotic, which is friggin' caused a hell of a lot of problems. And the whole mindset has created that, and now hospitals are dealing with it, to the same thing with genetics. We have to get an idea that just like we have mitosis and apoptosis, building and destroying of cells, we got reduction in oxidation, we've got acidity or alkalinity and acidity. We have recombination and ion, and you might say electron dissociation or ionization of atoms. We have building and destroying of generation annihilation of subatomic particles. We have pride and shame in our psyche. We have infatuation, resentment. We have build and destroy in our microtubules and structures inside the cell. Nature is building and destroying in order to transform so we can adapt. If we didn't have the ability to build and destroy, we couldn't adapt. And adaptation is essential. That's what distress is, the inability to adapt to a changing environment. So by having the ability to adapt, building and destroying is necessary as a conservation of all the reusable materials. And so one good is not just live and dead is bad. That model is just a moral hypocrisy. Dying is sometimes essential. You have to have, you can't have fingers like this. When you're born with a big web, and then apoptosis destroys these cells in here and leaves the fingers you have. And if you didn't have death, you couldn't have life. And the same thing in many other tissues of your body. You're born with branchial arches, and eventually that apoptosis comes and takes things away, and you're born as a human structure. So what happens is you have to have death and life together. You have to have transformation. Evolution is transformation, requiring an adaptation with both birth and death, life and death. DNA must have both. We must, if we're all of a sudden not developing an offspring that's healthy, we're going to kill it. Half the babies don't even make it into the uterine wall because they're not strong enough to make it into the uterine wall to implant, and they're expelled, and we're killing them. You'd be surprised, half of all pregnancies don't make it. And what's interesting is because they're not strong enough to be able to fight against the mother's wall, fights the child to make sure it's strong enough to implant, or otherwise it says, forget, reject it. And we have these allied ideas that somehow abortion's bad or rejection's bad, but nature's doing it. It's not attached to life over death. It understands that we need both at all scales of existence. The whole solar system has life and death cycles. Humans do, species do. 99% of all species have extinct on the planet. And so we gotta change our perspective that one is good and the other is bad. Oh, you have a baby born. Oh, I'm so celebrating. Fantastic. Oh, you died. Oh, I'm sorry. Bullshit. In the Demartini method inside C and the breakthrough experience, I show that those are both illusions. And when we get that, we understand that genetic causes of disease may be perceived differently in the decades to come. We may perceive it purposeful, and we may find that it's on the way, not in the way. And we just had too narrow of a mind, and we're too rigid about the belief system, about genetics, to finally get an understanding that genes are working on a more teleological, purposeful objective, not just random mutations. Because it's just like, I've never been satisfied with random events in the sense of injury. When I see people going in injury, I've seen injury after injury in my practice. I find that there's a cocky, manic, elated state of mind that's drawing in those events, and they're not random. When people are looking for protection, they attract violent situations. There's a pattern there, and the genes are doing the same thing. And I've been working on that, and I just wrote something about it yesterday. I'll probably publish that and introduce that into my programs, because I think it's time to adjust that. The microbiome used to be all bugs are bad. Bullshit. The microbiome is a regulated system that you need build and destroy of microorganisms. They have to be there at the right ratios to do it. And the same in the cells in the body. Some got to live, some got to die, and they got to be in the right ratios to have wellness. When we finally get that, and we understand that genes are no different, that they confer both advantages and disadvantages, and they're neither good nor bad, and they have to have both life and death components to it, we'll have a more understanding, a more powerful understanding of how genetics works in health and disease. And I'm not even convinced that the things we label disease are really disease. They may be healthy responses to our perceptions, our decisions, and our actions, trying to guide us back to living in a more moderate fashion.
Thanks for that, Dr. DeMartini. Dr. DeMartini, Athena Ali is asking, do you have an opinion or observation of why so many women in particular suffer from thyroid conditions?
Yes, I just addressed this the other day in my program on P2, Prophecy 1-2 experience. I saw a pattern starting when I was around 25, 6, 7, and then into my practice years. I saw a pattern that many women, now today it's changing because women are now becoming, more liberated, and they're starting businesses and they're not depending on guys and things of this nature, which is more androgynous. But what was going on even 40 years ago and 50 and 60 years ago, you had more of a kind of a sexual dimorphism and a difference between what men and women do. In the underdeveloped countries, you still see this. So what you had is you had men go to work, they provided resources for the family, and women were involved in reproduction to make the kids. That was the pattern. Now that's changing drastically now. But at the time, when I was in professional school, almost 40 years ago, I noticed that the women that were having the low thyroid, had a pattern. And I mean, it's very common that women would get married, usually in their 20s, they'd have babies starting mid-20s. They'd have one or two or three. By the time they're 30, they had sometimes two or three kids. And what happens, they had a bit of a fantasy that the guy was going to come home and share in the family stuff. And the guy who has a different set of values, who's balancing out the woman who's focusing on that, has to have a value on resources or there's no provisions for the family. And the man goes off, works harder. And every time there's another baby, he works harder. And by the time they had the second house, the bigger house, because they need more rooms for the house, they got to even work harder. And so the woman is sort of resenting that they're trapped at home and they've maybe lost their freedom in some respects, unless that's their highest value. And then the man feels like he's upset because, God, I'm working my ass off to pay a mortgage and paying credit cards, and there's an overspending, and there's a conflict there. Very common conflict. That's the most common conflicts, sex and money, kids and money. And so the woman is now not in the working situation. Maybe when she was in her late teens, 20s, she started doing jobs and things, but she's now no longer self-sufficient financially. And so she's dependent on the guy, and he's now having a wall up, and he's wanting to go to work and stay at work, and she's going to be at home, and there's just this conflict. And so she's repressing what she's wanting to say to him because she's dependent, and if she stirs too much up, she could be trapped without having security for the kids. So there's a repression going on. Now, the thyroid gland originates from the foramen cecum, which is, if you go back, there's two-thirds of the tongue and one-third of the tongue, and or one-third of the tongue and two-thirds of the tongue and one-third of the tongue. One is the sugar receptors, then there's the salt receptors, and on the back is bitter receptors. And the junction between bitter and salt receptors is the foramen cecum, which is a little opening. And it actually goes and develops what is called a thyroglossal diverticulum. The diverticulum becomes a thyroglossal duct. The duct ends up dividing into two lobes in the mesenchyme. It's an endodermal tissue that goes into the mesenchyme and penetrates the mesenchyme, the mesoderm. And then what happens is it starts creating thyroid lobes. There's an isthmus between it, sometimes a third lobe. And they basically sit there and grow. And because they originate from the tongue, they're involved in metabolism. So if you have low thyroid, your metabolism slows down and you gain weight, you get a bowling pin look. But it was also involved in speech, the tongue. So that means you have slurred speech, slow speech, hesitant speech. And people that are hesitating in speaking up about what they want in life, they're the ones that are having the low thyroid. And the people who are the other side of the coin, the hyperthyroid, are the people that tactlessly, righteously say what it is, not worrying about it. So if you're a female and you're more the one that's running the business and the guy's more the home guy, he's taking care of the kids, then you might be on the other side and you may be the one that's talking excessively and telling the guy what to do and not worrying about what he says tactlessly. And that's the hyperthyroid. So people that speak up and don't worry about what people think and just project downward what they think and what they believe downward without factoring other people's values, the thyroid goes up, metabolism goes up, and they get thinner, they have bulging eyes, and they're more assertive and more fast talking. The other one are more squinty eyes, more bowling pins look, gaining of weight, scanty hair, obese, slow speech, slurred speech, etc. So what you say, how you say it makes a difference. Now, when you're living by your highest values and you have more balanced orientation, you have a good communication. You're not putting yourself above or below. But when you're going down in your lower values and you're injecting the values of others and you feel proud when you're fitting the ideals of conformity or you feel ashamed, you put yourself up or down and you can volatilize the expression of the thyroid. But if you get stuck on one side and get narcissistic, your diabetes blood sugar goes up and your thyroid goes up. Your growth hormone even goes up. If you get on the other side, it does the opposite. Glucagon goes up. So what happened, or glucagon goes down. So what happens is you automatically are creating with your psychology these increases and decreases in hormonal function. If I was to go in and all of a sudden a lion was to come racing towards you and about to eat you, I guarantee your cortisol would go up, your testosterone would go up, your norepinephrine, epinephrine would go up, your osteocalcin would go up. You'd be having certain triggered hormones that would go up in seconds. But we store in our subconscious mind a lot of emotional imbalanced perspectives that we've never neutralized, and they're basically affecting our neurochemistries and our transmitters and hormones. And these are all signal molecules that are basically running the body, and we are literally having reasons why that's there. When a doctor says, well, you've got a biochemical imbalance, he's not asking, he's not going farther. He's just saying, well, there's the fact, it's blood is throwing it, so here's the drug. And to me, that's ludicrous. That's a model that's not causal, it's correlative. Correlative means that you just because you have a high thyroid or a low thyroid doesn't mean that that's the cause of it. That could be the effect of a long series of chronic perceptions that are doing it. And I'd rather give people their power back than take their power away. The pharmaceutical, once you give you a drug, I'm trying to give you your power back by teaching you what you can do to make those changes in your chemistry yourself. If you can't do it and you're not disciplined and you're not doing it, well, then fine. We've got the drugs to manufacture to do it. But I would rather give people their power back and give them their control and make them realize that the real pharmaceutical company is inside their brain, then they have control over it.
And Dr. DeMartini, you talk about the four cardinal pillars of healing, gratitude, love, certainty, and presence. Why are these so powerful factors in well-being?
Well, those are ones that I've observed. When I was in my University of Houston, and I was interested in healing, I started really being fascinated about healing, obviously, when I was sick, 17, 18 years old. I had the strychnine poisoning, cyanide poisoning. So I was interested in how physiology worked then. And then I, by the time I was 20, 21, 22 even, I was every time I could get anything on healing, I would go to seminars on it. I would go and visit them. I watched every kind of healing that was about. I looked for mainly alternative and holistic healing at the time, but I also had the opportunity to work with people in orthodox medicine. I got to work with Dr. Denton Cooley, who is the leading cardiovascular surgeon in the world, did open heart transplants and stuff. I got to watch them in the domes and make friends with them and do his rounds with him and talk to him and meet all the doctors there. And I met hundreds of doctors during the time I worked at the hospitals. But, you know, I was interested in the healing arts. And I think what's happened is we have the thing that's made the great doctors were common denominators. And these are the things that I observed in a great healer in every field, from chiropractic to osteopathic to naturopathic to allopathic to the shamanistic healing to dance therapy to you name it. I mean, I studied everything that was anything to do with healing at one time, nutritional healing. And I found there were four cardinal things. The individual who is the healer, quote, and I'm going to use that as a title because healing is really an inside job, maybe catalyzed and inspired by a person around it. But when they were grateful for what they were doing, when I saw chiropractors or dentists or podiatrists or any specialist, rheumatologist, didn't matter, when I saw them grateful for the opportunity to serve people, I saw that they really, really, really loved what they were doing. It's something that really, really meant a lot to them to be able to do that. That was their life's mission. It wasn't a job. It wasn't because, oh, it makes good money. None of that. It was because that was their mission and they really loved it and they were grateful for doing it. They're grateful to work with the patients to learn, because whatever's highest on our value, we love learning about and we love learning and becoming master at it. And they were more certain, because you're only certain when you're objective and when it's highest on your value and when you're present. That's when you have great healing powers. Dr. Denton Cooley, one of the things that is a cardiovascular surgeon, as I said, I got to make rounds with him. I watched him go room to room, and after he'd do the surgeries in the morning, because he started surgery at 7 a.m. and he worked till 2:00. So, and then he'd come do rounds in the afternoon. And I watched him grab the patient's hands and look him straight in the eyes with his disciples of 12 disciples around him. It's quite funny. And he'd grab their hands, look him straight in the eyes, and I did, and say to him, I just want to let you know that your surgery was a success and that soon you'll be able to be home with your grandkids. And soon you'll be able to work in the garden again and pick the flowers and you'll be able to cook the meals. And they're talking to elderly people, particularly the female or something, or the man he'd talk about, soon you'll be able to go out and play golf again or whatever it is. And he was present with them. He was demonstrating a real love for what he was doing. And I watched that bedside manner, and very few people built a $1 billion cardiovascular center like he did, because he had those four cardinal pillars. I saw that with Jim Parker. Jim Parker had an influence in the chiropractic profession. And he said that you had present time consciousness, which I call presence, approbation, approval, and appreciation, which I call gratitude. He said the love concept for love. And he said that you've got to also have faith, constant belief in your product, service, and idea, which is certainty. So he had the same model, same thing, but an individual that has those four things heals within. And the individual that has those four things in their healing arts helps people heal from within also, because it takes away the volatilities of emotions and gets you into what is called the transcendental state. The transcendental feelings are gratitude, love, inspiration, enthusiasm, certainty, and presence. So if you put inspiration in what you're doing and you put enthusiasm into your daily work and you put those six things together, You could say those four cardinal pillars plus those two additional, inspiration, enthusiasm, are still the greatest healers. No matter what field you go into in the healing arts, if you have those there, you're going to excel.
Thanks for that, Dr. DeMartini. And that brings me to my last question. I know you have, you know, out of everything you've explained today and that you've shared with us, you've created the method called the DeMartini method. For those that don't know it, can you please explain a bit more about that?
Well, the DeMartini method is something I started working on when I was 18, believe it or not. And I say that by saying that when my uncle sent two giant crates of books to my house, and I opened them up and I read two particular books of those many thousands that he sent. One of them was the Discourse on Metaphysics by Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. And he said that there was a perfection in the universe that man could never improve on. And I asked my students jokingly, right now I'm going to give you an essay test, and your job is to create a universe more magnificent than what we've got. And, you know, jokingly, people kind of go, how do I create a greater universe? Because sometimes they don't appreciate the way the universe is set up. But by actually appreciating the way it is, and realizing that it's actually quite magnificent, that's a part of it. But he said in his book, Discourse of Metaphysics, that there was a divine perfection. Now, he was a theological oriented guy. Not all people are, but he believed there was a divine perfection. David Bohm would call it the infinite order. But there was a divine perfection, a divine beauty, a divine love in the universe that few people ever got to know about. But those that do, that their lives are changed forever. When I read that, I couldn't help but have a tear in my eye, which has been a guide for inspiration my whole journey. And I kind of documented that. And I said, I want to be one of those individuals that understand that perfection. I want to understand that, what's the hidden order in the chaos? And that's been the pursuit ever since. Then I came across another book that was not an easy book to read, a lot harder than the first one, by Paul Dirac, the Nobel Prize winner, on particle and antiparticle physics. And when you're sitting at 18 years old and you don't even have a vocabulary yet, you have to have a dictionary out and multiple dictionaries out to keep up with this book. But he said in there that you took a particle and an antiparticle, you joined them together. And when they found each other and they combined, they made light. And when I said that, I was naive and I really didn't have my background in physics yet, in chemistry. But I thought, well, I wonder what would happen if we took positive and negative emotions and put them together, could we make enlightenment? And a simple little thing like that went through my head, and I kept that in the back of my mind. And what if that was the perfection? Because I always thought of light was in Buddhism as the enlightened mind, right, is aware. And then and light was considered theologically as the divine perfection. So I just kind of wove these superficially together in my mind and went on a pursuit to study everything I could get my hands on that might assist in helping an individual do that. Over the years, I learned a lot of different components, and I started to gradually put together a model, a method that could help people find the hidden order, find the perfection. And I realized that the first step was identifying the things that we see as disorder, the things that we're infatuated with, or the things that we resent, that we look up to and minimize ourselves over, the things we look down on and exaggerate ourselves over, and lose our real authenticity. Because when we're proud or shamed, we're not being ourselves. And when we're infatuated or resentful, we're not seeing them as themselves. So I realized the first step was to own the traits. So I started developing the DeMartini method many, many years ago, trying to have a reflective awareness between self and other. That was the primordial thing. I even called the method the retrogenesis process. I imagined Adam and Eve joining together and becoming Adam Kaman, which is the one that had grace with the divine. It was just a metaphor. But little did I know that turned out to be an amazing realization. And I used to have my students go through and make a list of everything they admired or despised about an individual, not just a few, but just everything they could think of, and make a balanced list and then own them all. And I went and did 4,628 traits and found out I had every trait that a human being could have. There was nothing missing in me. And when you realize at the level of the soul, nothing's missing, at the level of the senses, things appear to be missing. And the ones that appear to be missing are the things you're too proud or too humble to admit, and you're deflecting your true self and not being true to yourself, then really the ownership of those traits were the first step. So I incorporated that into the DeMartini method many years back. Then I realized that the things that I thought were positive had downsides. The thing I thought were negative had upsides. So then the next step was to balance those equations. They're like mathematical equations, the balance between self and other and the balance of positive and negative. And then I started to go in there and I started saying, well, okay, this thing that I'm looking up to, that I'm infatuated with, I'm blind to the downside. What's the downside to that? Because when you're infatuated and you're thinking, oh my God, this is it, you got a fatal attraction, you don't see the downside. Your intuition is trying to point it out, but you're not listening. And when you're resentful, you're not seeing the upside. So what I did is I put questions in place to make you cognizant of those sides you're ignoring. So your unconscious is brought conscious, you're fully conscious. And now you're fully conscious, you see both sides, you realize, you know what, the trait that I thought was admirable or despisable, despicable, wasn't. It's just a trait. I'm not a nice person or a mean person. I'm a human being, and I plays out different roles at different times. And there's a need for both sides. There's a time for everything under the sun, as they say. And then I realize that when I do that, not just them doing that, but when I do that, there's also two sides. So then I added another column in the method to balance out my perception myself, so my pride and shame would be centered. So now I'm not infatuated or resentful in column three. I own the traits in column two, identify the traits in column one, and then I'm balancing them in column three in them, and then I'm balancing them in me in column four. Then I realized that I added another component. I found out that every person that's got a trait has the opposite trait. I'm not nice all the time. I'm nice at times and I'm mean at times. I'm kind at times, I'm cruel at times. I'm honest at times, I'm dishonest at times. I'm playful and I'm serious. And I realized that I have all the traits and that they have both sides. And to label me one and more than the other is skewed. It's a subjective bias of narrow minds projected onto me or that I project on myself. So what I did is I made an accountability to become cognizant consciously of unconscious memories of where I did the opposite traits. I wouldn't label myself and I wouldn't label other people. And so that way we actually see people for who they are, not for what we think they are and our bias towards them. And it dissolves the bias like a double blind study to clear out the bias. And what this is doing is allowing us to start to realize that this is a human being and they're worthy of love. And then I did a great discovery when I was writing a book on the origin of life. That I wrote these two big volumes on how life may have been created and the origin of it. And so when I was doing it, I was studying redox reactions and I realized you can't have an oxidation without a reduction. They're always paired. But when somebody challenges, you oxidize. When somebody supports you, you reduce. I thought, wow, that means that this is going on simultaneously. So then I realized I started asking questions and I worked on it for 2 years before I put it into the program, into the breakthrough experience and into the method to make sure it was solid. I did thousands of examples in my own life where something was occurring, where the opposite was occurring. And that was a mind blower. I realized that there was not only a hidden order, an implicate order in the universe, but it was demonstrable and repeatable and you could see it. And then it made me realize that, wow, there's a way of demonstrating a higher panpsychic intelligence in the universe that philosophers have been thinking about for centuries. There's a way of demonstrating it. And there's a synchronicity and that everything is trying to get you to be centered, to be able to live by your highest value, to maximize your performance and potential in life. And then I realized that sometimes people have fantasies about how life's supposed to be, and they're holding on in comparison of their current reality to fantasies and depressing themselves. So then I added another column to it, and I found out at the moment they did a trait, if they had done the opposite trait, the way you hoped they'd have been, what would have been the drawback? And I'm cracking the fantasies and cracking the nightmares and centering it so you're not comparing your current reality to fantasies about how it is. Because what is what is. What you fantasize is not real. What it was supposed to be in the future or what it was in the past is not what it is right now. You only got the present. So those help you get in the present. Then I went further with it. And I went into, I looked at the exact moment when somebody's criticizing you about something you did in the past, somebody simultaneously praising you about what you're about to do in the future. And you are not aware of it. And you're going to be emotionally reactive and be a victim over here, but you're not realizing that this is going on over here and you're actually attracted to it. And so I basically go further. And there's 80 columns in all of the method. And those right there are just the first few. And what it does is it helps you see things as they are objectively and takes you back to your highest value and your telos, where it allows you to bring wellness and actually show you how to empower all seven areas of your life. Because in your mind, anytime you're not balanced, you got noise in the brain and you're not present and not creative. And it's only when you're in objective states where you're willing to go after things that inspire you, that challenge you, that you get your creativity at its max. And also in business, if you're talking down and you're coming from a pride level and talking down, you're not meeting your customers' needs. And if you're coming down, you're giving away your profits. And in a business, if you're emotionally elated or depressed, you're not going to manage money properly. You're going to use other people's money and get over leverage, or you're going to sell out at the bottom of the market because you're going to be in fear. And the same thing in relationship. If there's no equity, there's no communication. In social leadership, you got to be able to lead people, but you got to meet their needs in order to lead them. The charisma is not about you. The charisma is how they feel they're getting their values met by you. And in physical form, all your symptoms are guiding you into equanimity. And spirituality is equanimity. So the method, it helps you empower all seven areas of life. And it's a science. It's duplicatable. It's reproducible. It's methodical. You have to face the truth of yourself. And most people want to live in the fantasy, but it makes them accountable to be truthful to themselves about who they are, so they can set real goals with real times and have real strategies to get real outcomes.
This was just a small sample of what Dr. DeMartini has to share. If you'd love to continue learning from Dr. DeMartini, please click the subscribe button so that you're notified when we add the next episode. If you'd love to find out more about the mind-body connection or about Dr. John DeMartini's work, then log on to our website, drdemartini.com, and use the online chat function to talk to a member of the DeMartini team. We'd love to meet you, get to know you, and understand what you'd love to achieve so that we can best guide you through the appropriate education session to achieve your goals and dreams. We'd also love to invite you to join us in the DeMartini Stay Inspired Facebook group, which you can access by linking to demartini.inc/inspired. You'll find the link in the episode description. Our goal in this community is to help you to clarify your vision, stay inspired, and take the action steps to empower all areas of your life. So join us and the global community online by linking to demartini.inc/inspired. That's it for this episode. We look forward to sharing more